In 2023, China Talk is going to Congress. Our first guest of the series is Ro Khanna, Democratic representative of the 17th Congressional District of California, which represents Silicon Valley. We'll get into the congressman's visions of economic patriotism, the future of American industrial policy, the China Committee, and maybe a little AI too. Co-hosting with me today is Associate Director at the Federation of American Scientists, Divyansh Kaushik. Welcome to China Talk, you two.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Jordan, for having me co-host this. And thanks, Congressman, for joining us. The administration put forward this, what they call the modern American industrial policy. And Congress has put hundreds of billions of dollars towards this whole idea that, you know, we have to steer investments or crowd in capital. Say if 10, 20 years from now, this were to fail, what would, in your view, be the biggest reason? And what would, in your view, would be the biggest reason for its success?
Well, the failure would be because we weren't strategic enough. I've called in the Foreign Affairs article and with Senator Rubio for the creation of an economic development council, like a National Security Council, that would get all of the agencies on the same page under the direction of the president, that would make sure that we had a coordinated response and an expeditious response, and that we were targeting places that had faced deindustrialization, that we had a comprehensive approach, not just the financing of capital for factories, but making sure that we were streamlining permitting without compromising the environment, making sure that labor standards were being upheld, making sure we were investing in the workforce. And so I expect some of the things to succeed, but if there were failures, it would be because of the lack of coordination and planning.
And what would be some of your reasons for its success?
Well, I think the CHIPS Act, the CHIPS and Science Act were very strong. Of course, I'm biased. I was a original author of it with Senator Schumer, Todd Young, and Mike Gallagher. But there you have the government cooperating with the private sector, financing new factories, an effort with the state government also investing in new workforce. And you have investments in new science and technology. So I think that close collaboration between government, educational institutions, and the private sector, as well as labor, is so critical.
So you mentioned sort of being strategic, and you listed a number of sort of potential priorities for American industrial policy, but sort of being strategic ultimately means making trade-offs. So, you know, when you're talking about regional diversity and looking at industry by industry, like, what is your preferred sort of framework that you would want to sort of impose on whoever is going to do the analysis that would try to maximize whatever return that Congress is hoping its monies will end up bringing back to the American people and, you know, future economic growth?
Well, I would look for a moonshot of economic revitalization in factory towns that have been shuttered, in communities that have been decimated because of 70,000 factories closing and the offshoring of jobs. So I look at places that have faced that kind of economic devastation and say, how can we have economic redevelopment there, and what kind of industries, what kind of supply chains can thrive in those places? The second thing I would look at is, how do we lower our trade deficit, particularly with China, but also globally, and have that as a metric in our consideration. And the third thing I would look at are, what are some of the key industries where new technology and innovations in manufacturing process can have that being done in the United States? Semiconductor chips, steel, alumina, battery plants, all are candidates for that.
So you mentioned financing before, and identifying these industries, and and your work with Senator Rubio on this, you introduced the National Development Strategy and Coordination Act recently. And part of that, for our readers and listeners, is that it also gives $20 billion to Treasury's Federal Financing Bank to crowd in other federal financing investments. Congressman, could you share your vision with our audience? And if you don't mind, also your thoughts on how the private sector investors should view this opportunity of crowding in capital.
Well, this is building on the work of the CHIPS Act, but the idea is that we should have an economic development council like the National Security Council that helps finance new industries in places that have been left out of the global economy, particularly in strategic industries. that has all of our federal agencies and government working together to streamline the process of building these new industries, and that is providing federal capital if the private sector is investing in America. We're not going to give a tax debt or subsidies for CEOs to pocket that money and then build the factories in Malaysia or Vietnam. But if they're building the factories in the United States, if they can meet the rigors of the free market by getting some seed private capital, then that private capital can be scaled with the federal investment. And the federal investment, federal financing bank should be looked at as a scaling bank, one that allows market-tested technology that's being invested in the United States to scale into factories.
Could you talk a little bit about the appetite for bipartisan spending and sort of dollars around these sorts of things, which I think, you know, a decade ago, it was only Rubio on the other side of the aisle. And now we're having more and more folks of the Republican persuasion be open to this sort of stuff. Do you see this as something that could last decades or more? Or was there something particularly unique about, you know, the post-COVID moment maybe that allowed these bills to get across the finish line?
I do think there was a uniqueness to the post-COVID moment where people said, we didn't make masks in America. We didn't make enough baby formula in America. We don't make Tylenol, enough Tylenol in America. What happened? How is it that we're waiting and so dependent with the trucks lying vacant because we don't have a semiconductor chip? It jolted America into understanding the value of manufacturing and production. And there has been a bipartisan activity, but the Republican Party, honestly, is a bit divided, schizophrenic on this. You have Rubio, who takes it seriously on economic development vis-a-vis China. You have people go on the Freedom Caucus who say, I don't want to spend a dollar. I don't care what it's for. And so it's a tension within the Republican Party. Which direction are they going to go? In smart government productive spending or in vocal opposition to all government spending? And that's, I think, why Rubio and I are off by a factor of a couple zeros. I want $2 trillion of this over 10 years to really revitalize industry. He's for $20 billion. I appreciate intellectually him joining this and with some courage to get on a bipartisan bill. But to really do this in a way that people are going to feel, we need to have the investment behind it.
Let's talk a little bit about the Democratic caucus for a second. You know, what are the sort of different strains of how people are viewing these sorts of initiatives from your side of the aisle?
I think that some people are, most of the Democratic caucus is fine on the research and technology aspect of it. There's probably some division on how much do we want to support industry in doing it and how much do we want to support the private sector in doing it, and how much do we just want these to be government jobs. I point to Roosevelt's famous speech, FDR speech, where he talked about the right to a job. That was not a right to a job just in government. It was a right to a job in private, in mining, in construction, a lot of private industries when FDR talked about it. 85% of jobs in this country are private sector jobs. We want to make sure that private sector jobs are part of the development narrative, but they need to be conditioned on good labor standards. But the big debate, I think, in our caucus is how much do we support a company like Intel in building these factories when it is a private sector company? And what are the conditions limiting stock buybacks or for labor pay that are critical?
Talking about supporting Intel and Chips and Science. So last year, when Congress was deliberating on Chips and Science Act, over 4 dozen national security leaders wrote to Congress, including former secretaries of defense, energy, homeland security, CIA, NSA directors, even a former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, who wrote that, you know, we need to pair this with talent reforms. And they specifically called on Congress to look at STEM immigration as a critical component for Chips and Science. And that clearly did not go anywhere. And last year, but you've got a great bipartisan working relationship on the Hill. So do you think that there is an opportunity to do some of that work in this Congress?
I'm going to try to build the Intel factories in Ohio to create the blue collar jobs. You need the PhDs, and to have those PhDs who understand semiconductor production. Right now, many of them aren't in the United States. I want massive investment in the engineering programs, in the PhD programs, in the STEM programs in the United States to revitalize our capacity to lead in these areas. But we also need to complement that with immigration that will allow for the manufacturing to lead, if allow us to lead in manufacturing in this country. Of course, it's personal to me. My father immigrated to America, coming to Michigan, studying chemical engineering in the 1960s, when America said we needed immigrants to win the Cold War. So I will continue to work on immigration reform and link that to our manufacturing agenda, link it to our place-based agenda, that we know that when you have this kind of immigration with incredible talent into a community, it creates economic growth.
China is projected to graduate twice as many PhD students by 2025 as compared to the United States. How do you view like investments? You just talked about the role of immigration reform. You think there are additional steps Congress should be taking on STEM education as well for domestic students as well?
Yes, we need to make STEM the part of national pride, national renewal. I think that starts with simple things as the president of the United States recognizing through prizes, through events, the Oscar-like events, the value of STEM in this country. And then, of course, it needs to be financed. I would say we should be financing STEM PhDs. They may be having a free education. Maybe we pay them for their living expenses or allow them to earn an income. We need to provide tax incentives for people to go in to STEM fields where they may be saving on their taxes to incentivize people doing these PhDs instead of just having our best and brightest go to Wall Street or into software in Silicon Valley. We're going to have a whole of nation approach in building the PhD and college STEM talent that we need.
So let's talk a little bit about the China Committee. What are your sort of thoughts, reflections, hopes, dreams, worries about where Representative Gallagher might be taking this this initiative?
Well, I voted for the committee. I have a good relationship with Representative Gallagher. We came into Congress together. He's a Marine, a PhD. We don't always agree, but I think he's going to be serious about the security risk that Taiwan poses, about making sure that there's deterrence for any military invasion. But I do want us to focus also on the economic issues, on the immigration issues. We need to make sure that if we're going to compete with China, that we have a rational immigration policy, that we have a rational policy on STEM education that allows for production to return, and that we rebalance our trade deficit. And if Leader Jeffrey selects me to be on that committee, I will be bringing that perspective to the committee.
Export controls for a little bit. What you want to take the pulse on Congress on how these sorts of actions that the BIS has been pushing have been taken, and you know what sorts of nudges Congress or the China Committee in particular might be interested in pushing around those lines?
Well, I think the export controls are important. I think that Jake Sullivan, National Security Advisor Sullivan, had a very important contribution here where he restricted advanced logic chips to go to China, or the tools that make advanced logic chips. And what was so impressive about this is he's gotten the commitments from now the Netherlands, Japan, also, I think, to restrict that. These restrictions have to be with our allies, or you're just penalizing American companies and not achieving the goal. So I would focus on the export restrictions on the most highly sensitive technology. On the other hand, we want to be exporting more of our products to China to reduce the trade deficit.
And Chairman Michael McCaul was chairing the House GOP China Task Force. Like, yeah, they made an offer initially to the Democratic Party as well to join, put members on the task force. The leadership decided not to, and so they went on their own. How do you anticipate, like, Mike Gallagher has also said that he wants to use the work of that task force as, you know, to guide his work on the committee. How do you see that playing into the potential bipartisanship on this committee?
Well, the task force, I think, is very different than a committee of Congress. The committee of Congress has much more formal standing. And the good news so far is that the ratio 9-7 is a pretty fair ratio. So it suggests that they want Democratic participation. There are a number of areas where Democrats see eye to eye. We see eye to eye that China should not in any way militarily invade Taiwan with the Republicans. We see eye to eye that there needs to be an economic rebalancing, that there shouldn't be intellectual property theft. Now, there are places where Democrats want to be sure that we don't engage in xenophobia, that we don't engage in anti-China bashing, that we don't push us towards a Cold War, and we will bring that perspective. But I'm hopeful it'll be a serious committee that looks at what the posture should be towards China in the 21st century and will outlive this Congress and become a permanent select committee, much like the Intelligence Committee.
We focus a lot, and in Congress too, it seems we focus a lot on disentangling the U.S. from China. Do you see like there are areas of cooperation where we need to double down instead?
There are obviously areas where we do need to cooperate. Climate change, where we can. We need to work with China on tackling pandemics, where we can. We need to have a dialogue with the public health agencies, transparency, rules of transparency with them. We need to maintain dialogue so that there isn't a risk of accidental war. So I am for engagement, but with an engagement with open eyes, and with a concrete goal of lowering our trade deficit to bring jobs home and not have this massive offshoring of our production.
Sure. Coming to your foreign affairs piece, one of the arguments you make is that there's a universe in which Beijing potentially could get on board with an initiative that the U.S. would push forward to lower the trade deficit. Talk a little through the logic of what you hope U.S. policymakers, American industry, as well as leadership in Beijing could go down to sort of realize your vision of how this relationship could potentially evolve on a healthier track.
Well, first, we need to demand that we're going to lower the trade deficit. It's gone from 60, 70 billion to almost 400 billion and make that very clear to the Chinese government. When I met with the Chinese ambassador, I said that, and I also said that to the extent we're going to affirm our one China policy, that becomes easier to do if the trade deficit is lowered and people in this country don't think that their parents' jobs were shipped to China and their jobs are continuing to be shipped to China. So one of the interests that China has is just to have a more constructive relationship with the United States. Second interest is they have a huge market in the United States. If we start imposing tariffs, that's going to hurt them a lot more than it will hurt us just because of the nature of the trade deficit. The third incentive they have is long-term. Xi Jinping has spoken about increasing consumer demand. They have a economy that is way too dependent on a few Communist Party apparatchiks and factories and not on a broad-based consumer demand-driven economy. Now, they have a need for jobs, and that's why they've been prioritizing it. But if they don't increase the consumer demand, that's not a long-term sustainable strategy. And so rebalancing to some extent is in their long-term interest.
Do you think China could do anything over the near to medium term to sort of change the temperature of how Congress sees China or the future of the relationship?
Yes. I mean, stop the artificial depreciation of their currency by buying up American reserves, and two, to work with us to lower the trade deficit, to identify places where they would buy from American industry and where they would stop subsidizing cheap imports that are dumping into the U.S. markets.
If China's growth slows into the medium term, and we're talking sort of 1-3% growth over the next 3 to 5 years, does that make them a less scary competitor going forward?
Well, they've slowed to about 3% for the first time. I don't wish any country a lower growth that hurts their own people. And I don't think that we should be counting on the other team, the other side failing. That would be like going into a football game saying we're only going to score 7 points because the other team is not going to score. I think we need to make sure that we have a strategy that assumes that China will rebound and be strong.
Any thoughts on TikTok? Is this something Congress should take on? Okay to leave to the executive branch?
I don't think Congress should get involved. I mean, my view of the ideal solution is the forced sale of TikTok so that people can still use it, but their data isn't going to the Chinese Communist Party. President should be headed in that direction. I know he's reviewing it, and Congress should weigh it.
Congressman, have you used ChatGPT?
I have.
What'd you ask it to do?
I was candidly very unimpressed. I was on the floor of the House of Representatives, and Jonathan Jackson, was a brilliant guy, son of Jesse Jackson, civil rights hero. He told me that we were talking about Martin Luther King Day, and he told me that that Thoreau, who I knew had influenced Gandhi's civil disobedience, that Thoreau actually was influenced by the Bhagavad Gita. And I didn't know that. Jonathan Jackson knew that. And he said, you should really read Thoreau's writing. He was influenced by the Gita. And that informed his views on civil disobedience. So I was kind of feeling like, well, what is this ChatGPT thing? Can it give me as much insight as Jonathan Jackson, who's not a philosopher, but certainly understands the history of the civil rights movement? And I asked ChatGPT, in what way was Thoreau's writing on civil disobedience that influenced Gandhi influenced by the Gita? And I got an essay that I wouldn't have given a passing grade if they had written for that at Stanford, basically saying, Thoreau, look to the Gita. Gandhi, look through the Gita, dressed up with fancy words and paragraphs, but with no depth of analysis. Then I realized, well, if coders are writing how to do the searches, are the coders philosophers? Are they philosophers to the level that Jonathan Jackson is thinking about this? So I'm fine. I think it's going to help people better than Cliff Notes and probably write fine papers and probably do a lot of tasks, but it's a far way from deep thinking.
So we'll, in 6 months, we'll ask it the same question and see if it does any better. Why should people read the Gita?
Gita is one of the most profound books. It's like the Bible. It's full of lessons about life. The central lesson, of course, is to do your duty without a concern for the external rewards. And that ultimately, if you do that, the rewards will follow.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Coming back to AI for a bit. The AI Act that Congress passed a couple of years ago, like established the National AI Research Resource Task Force at the NSF. The work has been going on for about a year now. They released an interim report say that calls for about like thinks about the $1.2 billion investment over 6 years, essentially creating a national AI research cloud, providing, you know, democratizing access to AI resources, providing academia, small businesses, the same level of compute that, say, Google or OpenAI have. Do you have thoughts on whether once the final report is supposed to come out in a couple of weeks, I believe, do you have thoughts on, like, whether Congress would be willing to spend on democratizing access to compute? Like, you know, the whole idea being a kid sitting in Akron would have similar access and they could do the same level of research that someone at MIT or Stanford is able to do.
And it's a wonderful idea. I think we want to be spending on democratizing access to technology. And we also want to be spending on AI's transformative possibilities. Right now, AI is so data dependent, and that is the model with which many tech companies are spending. But there's research being done at MIT or other places about how to make AI less data dependent. You know, when a young kid learns the word cat, they don't see thousands of pictures of cat. The human mind is more complex. So I'm all for federal research into AI to make it less data dependent.
What else do you think kind of Congress can do to get ready for the, you know, potentially transformative potential of these technologies?
Well, we have to be looking at jobs. What are the types of jobs in manufacturing and services that are going to be done? And how do we make sure those are good paying jobs? What are the jobs paying right now? I mean, a lot of AI is dependent on people who are inputting data, and those are very poorly compensated jobs. How do we make sure that those jobs are better compensated? How do we make sure AI is being used in ways that enhance productivity, even in the service sector, that make those jobs, home care or elder care, better compensating and more productive? Maybe they can do medical tests or help people take their medicine. What are we doing to limit the abuses of AI that perpetuate profiling or perpetuate our own biases? What are we doing to make sure that AI is safe? This entire framework is going to need thoughtful policy and regulation.
So maybe zooming out even further, your sort of top analytical questions that you wish you had answers to around, I don't know, industrial policy or technology policy more generally?
Well, the first would be case studies of where place-based economic development has worked, what the key ingredients of success in those areas are, where we should be targeting place-based economic development, what industries should those be focused on in particular geographies that are most likely to succeed. It is a huge undertaking, and that's why this council that I'm talking about should be reliant on the work of people like Danny Roderick and Gordon Hansen and others, and a battalion of economists to look at and inform policymakers. In terms of technology policy, what I would be most interested in is how do we democratize the gains of technology? We know that technology is going to lead to productivity increases. We know that it's going to lead to huge wealth generation. We know that it's being used to engineer the architecture of modern discourse, this podcast being one example. How do we make sure that more Americans and ultimately people in the world have access to technology, empowering them both as financial creators, as inventors, and as citizens?
It may strike some listeners as surprising that the representative from Silicon Valley, arguably the place in America that's benefited most from, you know, place-based economics or, you know, returns to like people living all together in one space, is so focused on kind of bringing that to the rest of the country.
Well, I can hawk my book, Dignity in a Digital Age, which is all about that. But the point is that you can't have a nation survive or thrive, certainly, if opportunity is concentrated to the level it has. And the whole hope of technology was decentralization. The whole idea is that you don't have to be congregated in a specific place in order to achieve your potential. I love Silicon Valley. I think it's wonderful to have that ecosystem, but we've got to create the other thriving ecosystems across the country and make sure that the prosperity of the Valley is linked to the prosperity of factory towns and rural communities and Black and brown communities across our nation.
We focused a lot on supply chain resiliency when we were, during the chip shortage, during the baby formula shortage. How do you view like the role of the federal government in stress testing supply chains and whether the administration should be taking a lead in that?
I do think the federal government should be looking at supply chains and where there are shortages and making sure that we're working with the private sector to address those. But I think this is, again, where this National Economic Development Council can do that, as opposed to ad hoc reports in a particular agency. We need to have a coordinated approach with the private sector on how do we rebuild industrial capacity in America.
I mean, I wonder to what extent these are like knowable questions. Like, you know, you can do stress tests of banks in 2006 based on your assumptions of what makes sense, yeah. And you could come up with flying colors. And then all of a sudden, you pull out some weird plank in the Jenga of the global supply chain, and all of a sudden, you know, you have five other things that you couldn't have even imagined were connected be falling through. So, I guess like. Information.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I challenges. Don't think anyone could have said that we would run out of baby formula or that we would need masks. Semiconductor chips probably more easily anticipated. But that is why I think a focus on building as much productive capacity in America is what's needed. And with that, good things will follow.
What aren't people talking about? That they should be. What should journalists be? Journalists and concerned citizens be prodding their representatives to be focusing on in 2023.
Well, where can we find common ground and a shared national purpose? In my view, that again is looking at places that have been left out, looking at why there's so much anger there, why people feel that the American dream is slipping away, and how do we renew that sense of possibility for people to be productive citizens, for them to have a livelihood that brings them economic security. I think those are areas where the country can fashion a common purpose and emerge from these tumultuous years with a shared vision, and that should be further explored.
Congressman, we end every episode with a song. Any song to capture your vision of a revitalized America, or your disappointment in ChatGPT's Thoreau analysis?
Well, Bruce Springsteen's My Hometown is pretty relevant. He is singing about leaving his hometown because of the closure of textile mills and how his son won't get to grow up there. And that captures it, I think, what many Americans went through in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Thanks so much for being a part of China Talk.
Thank you.
Vacant stores. Seems like there ain't nobody wants to come down here no more. They're closing down the textile mill across the railroad tracks. On and says these jobs are going, boys, and they ain't coming back to your home.
Hey there, China Talk listeners. This is Tracy Alloway.
And I'm Jill Wiesenthal, and we are the co-hosts of Bloomberg's Odd Lots podcast.
Yep, and if you enjoy China Talk, we think that you'll like Odd Lots too.
We have engaging conversations on everything from semiconductors to trade to AI to macroeconomic policy, and we always have the perfect guest.
Yep, you can check us out at Odd Lots on all the podcast platforms or Bloomberg.com/Odd Lots.